Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in Science, and I'm Maya Woolner, your podcast host today. This morning, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Theodore Porter about his new book, Genetics in the Madhouse, The Unknown History of Human Heredity, published by Princeton University Press in 2018. Dr. Porter is Distinguished Professor of History at University of California, Los Angeles, where he teaches in the history of science, medicine, and technology field. His publications include The Rise of Statistical Thinking from 1986, Trust in Numbers, The Pursuit of Objectivity in Science and Public Life from 1995, and Carl Pearson, The Scientific Life in a Statistical Age, 2004. Good morning, Dr. Porter. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
So let me start by asking you briefly to describe to our listeners what historical questions first animated your research for genetics in the madhouse.
I've been interested in the uses of numbers and statistics and data, in history for much of my career. I began this project trying to understand the relationship between the invention of genetics, which is very often dated to attributed to Gregor Mendel 30 years earlier, and then really dated to the rediscovery or the recognition of his work in 1900. And there's been a long debate about, which began in the time about the relation between a kind of understanding of human heredity or of heredity, which was about genes, and one which looked at the characteristics instead and was more densely statistical. It turns out that both sides are actually highly statistical, but I got into the project in its current form, and rather to my surprise, I discovered that there was this whole world of investigation of human heredity anchored in places like insane asylums. So that was what really got me. That was what really got me going. And the question then is the real issue is. Should we really be moving beyond seeing this as a work of science by a disinterested scientist, or in this case he's interested, say Mendel, and Mendelism is about reading, or is it? It forms into university programs and departments in the early 20th century. Is that really where genetics and the study of heredity begin, or are there these other kinds of institutions like insane asylums engaged in the very practical and troublesome business of trying to manage insanity and even to cure it? Is it rather out of this more engaged in administrative form rather than as a kind of basic science? So those are the kinds of questions that entered into this as I was formulating it.
And how would you summarize your essential argument in the book?
Now, the main point, first of all, is exactly that the insane asylums, and then beginning in the, let's say, 1870s or 1880s, we have to add in schools for children who were called feeble-minded. So I'll just use that word as if it were not offensive to anybody, but that's because that is the word they used the feeble-minded, that by the 1880s and 1890s was perhaps even more fundamental. But those two, so these two kinds of institutions are really the place where work on human heredity took shape. I've had some reviews already, and they tend to see the book before the material I cover before 1900 as showing the role of this dangerous, terrible field of eugenics in the rise of human heredity or in the science of heredity. And while in a way that's true, the argument actually kind of goes beyond eugenics or is not limited to eugenics. Certainly the motive for investigating heredity was in the 19th century, as it was in the early 20th century, was above all this concern about the effect on the quality of a population of letting people who had mental illness reproduce. So the eugenics is there all the way through. What surprised me more I hadn't appreciated how much discussion there was like that, but I was more surprised to discover that they were actually quite serious in their hereditary investigations. And there's a whole research tradition which is bound up with eugenics, but is not only eugenics, but it is a kind of, well, let's just say, a quantitative data-oriented a research on human heredity.
I see. So there's some terminology that I want to discuss before we get further into the details of the book. And so for the sake of clarity, I wanted to ask if you could explain to our listeners the difference between phenotypic and genotypic heredity. And does your work deal with both types, or do you focus on one over the other?
Okay, I mean, that's a quite fundamental issue, and it's a little bit what I was talking about already. Genotype in simple terms, is genes. The word genetics was coined about in the first decade of the 20th century. It was about genes. The new science of genetics was inspired by this excitement about Mendel's breeding experiments. Mendel's breeding experiments were kind of agriculturally oriented experiments on pea hybrids. It was really a study of hybridization, and maybe that could be a model for understanding all kinds of human heredity. So through the early 20th century, in that tradition, this genotypic tradition, this emphasis on genes, the idea of heredity was to find the genes for interesting characteristics, and that might be, milk production in cows or the quality of corn or something. And it might be, in eugenic terms, it might be something about people, whether they exhibit weaknesses like feeble-mindedness, whether they, achieve, greatness in, whatever, in science or athleticism or anything. So, but the orientation is absolutely towards the genes, and they were happiest in this early 20th century work when they found a discontinuous characteristic, that is to say, which had one form when the gene was present and some other form when the gene was absent. And there's a whole discussion and debate about whether mental illness or feeble-mindedness are like that. Quite a lot of effort to demonstrate that if it were true, I mean, that is, if it had worked out, then that would be those would be genotypic traits. That is, they would be coded by the presence or absence of some gene which could be spoken of as bearing that defect. The other way of doing it, which goes way back and is mainly what this tradition I have, uncovered was engaged in, didn't look for genes. First of all, they proceeded by measuring something or by registering its presence or absence. Do people who are in asylums tend to have children who also end up in asylums? Now, you know, if there were a gene, then you would expect it to happen, and there has to be some kind of genetic coding, I suppose. But to the extent that it's true, but the way of proceeding in the investigation is simply to look at the trait. Is the trait present or absent? Is the person, are the children of tall people tall, or are they, you know, are they average, or are they even, you know, so the way of studying this, which was then called, and now the word has changed its meaning, but biometric, but statistical is another version of this. The biometric way was to look at the traits and to measure them or to register their presence or absence, and not to assume that the characteristic had a single genetic unit, a gene or a genetic factor that either produced it or not. Or geneticists use the word segregation. That is to say, does it split between presence and absence of the gene? Can you see a radical difference between these things? For a thing like human height, let's say, or human abilities of various sorts, I don't think very many people think you see that kind of discontinuity. So anyhow, this tradition is mostly about looking at the measured characteristics and not assuming that they can be traced back to a gene or genetic element whose presence or absence determines what you see.
Thank you so much for that clarification. That's very helpful. So now I want to ask you, why do you begin the period that you cover in your book in 1789? And how did King George III of England's mental health initiate a debate about insanity and record keeping?
Right. The King George is an amazing story, and so it was kind of irresistible. And there's not a radical gap, but for a couple of decades, I don't really have anything else of that level of engagement. In some sense, it was irresistible, and it is more that it manifests things that were gradually developing than that it was itself an important event. In generating the kinds of activities that I write about, but it absolutely showed it reveals the serious beginning of record keeping as a public responsibility. Now, I mean, it is interesting. It's kind of the point of origin of all this is exactly record keeping, and institutions like insane asylums, which begin appearing in great numbers somewhat later, were expected to do that. The record keeping on let's say at Bethlehem is its real name. The famous London asylum was very scanty. There was some records around, and actually there were also records kind of kept but not published anywhere or printed, which people might, when they got interested, they would go looking for this. And then when the King George's madness inspired this important question, was the king likely to recover or not? If he wasn't going to recover, then it would make sense to appoint a regent to replace him. There also, the play and then film, which is the film, is called The Madness of King George, kind of brings this out nicely. There are lots of people who wanted the king to be found to be incurably insane so they could bring in a more kind of moderate, Whiggish, his son, who would be, allow more power to Parliament. So this vast debate about whether the evidence from previous experience with insane asylums, with patients of asylums, allowed one to believe that the king was likely to recover or not. And William Black, the doctor who had kind of cut his teeth in this kind of investigation, as many people did studying smallpox inoculation in the century before the cowpox, Jenner's cowpox vaccination, went into the records of the Bethlehem Asylum. They did not have public records of the kind he was looking for, but he discovered an apothecary, the druggist, or the kind of an assistant director of the institution, who was keeping them privately. So the story of King George, which is wonderfully, amazing for its itself, also brings out the pressures, which became quite intense, to have proper records on, you know, what was going on in these institutions. And the keeping of proper records and the either, you know, and making them available to the public, at least, or, well, I mean, to the public and for investigation is just the ground on which this whole study is built. It was only because there were these kinds of records that it was possible to have the kind of scientific or whatever scientific medical developments that I mostly describe in this book.
What were some of the ways in which early European and North American alienists, as psychiatrists were then called, used record keeping to investigate human heredity as a source of insanity? Maybe you can tell us about some of the particular individuals who were engaged in this process.
That's really the point where it all begins. And actually, already Black in 1790 published in his, he rewrote his book on the statistical causes of death, and he now included this material on Bethlehem Asylum, and he summed it up in a bunch of tables. So the table is going to be for quite a long time in this story the main vehicle of, you know, investigation and observation for looking at human heredity. He printed a table giving the distribution all the causes of insanity and how many of the patients at Bethlehem exhibited each of these. And one of those causes was family and hereditary. And it was the second largest number, but the largest number was kind of a grab bag of what they called moral causes, disappointment and, deaths in the family and things like that. So it was quite an important, it shows up as quite an important cause. In France, there's a table like that in 1816 using the great, based on the work of the great Paris hospitals. And then you see tables of this sort, appearing, gradually until I would say about the late 1820s or 1830s when it becomes quite routine. So the tables were, there are lots of the whole series of different tables that appear in all the reports. It's kind of a triumph of whatever data consciousness or statistics already that the reports of these, public or semi-public insane asylums were written by the medical superintendents or directors of the institutions were often very much oriented around the statistics. And one statistic that almost always appears, probably because it is the sort of thing that doctors would routinely put in their case reports from an earlier tradition, was the cause. So there would be a table of causes. They're idiosyncratic and quirky things in some ways, I could say a lot about that, but let's just say almost always there is a table of the causes of heredity and causes of insanity, and heredity was typically quite prominent among those. So the first part of this story is just very simply this move towards routine record keeping about causes of insanity. I'll just say a little bit more about that. I was, seeing all these tables, which I began the work, looking at data produced in around 1900. And then I came to recognize the importance of these institutions and I began tracing it back. And I found that it was already going on in the 1820s and 1830s. And I was extremely curious how did they get these kind of numbers? And part of the answer is easy and is, all over the archival records. They had big admission books and they wrote down, they entered all these, and each patient would have a horizontal line across the page or across two pages. And then there would be a lot of categories running from vertically. And one or two of those vertical columns would have something about the cause or cause. And maybe they would mention heredity specifically. I was surprised and impressed to discover this kind of information. And it was the So anyhow, it was easy to take the columns in the table and to add up the numbers and to produce, or the columns in the registration book and add up the numbers to produce a table. The next question is, what kind of an exchange happened between the doctor and somebody? Actually, I didn't even know for sure it was a doctor for a while, and then it became kind of clear to produce that kind of number. So that's the most basic level of this investigation, is just writing down a cause, which, as I think I now understand, usually came from a family member, but sometimes perhaps from the patient themselves, and also sometimes from the patient's physician or a public health doctor who had some role before the person was sent to the asylum for producing this number. But that's the most basic thing. And it was a big number. So as they became discouraged about curing their patients, they got more and more interested in obstructing the causes, obstructing the action of the causes. And there was this figure, this big figure for heredity in almost all the tables, and they got extremely interested in that. That's where the story kind of begins.
You have a very interesting discussion, I recall, about the reliability of family testimony as stating hereditary causes. So thank you very much for that. Who was Jules Baillarger, and how did his tabular forms inspire a shift away from the old one-dimensional asylum tables to statistics that tried to pose more specific questions?
Right. Baillarger is a... he was, among other things, he was the editor of the first of the lasting asylum journals, or journals of mental illness, in the early 1840s. And he was, there's quite a debate in France about whether to put any faith in these numbers at all. He was definitely on the side who did believe in the numbers. And he wanted to go beyond. He's one of the first people who wanted to go beyond simply writing down what the patient told him. I actually want to insert at this point just this interesting fact that it seems as if the patients did say heredity. That is, it wasn't that the doctor's heredity wasn't as a cause wasn't the doctor's idea. Heredity was also the way that family members and lay people talking about insanity understood it as hereditary when they saw a family member. So anyhow, but you have these sort of routinely collected tables, and is that a way you're going to learn anything about the real causes of heredity? Baillarger thought, well, not enough, that's too routine and not a real basis for investigation. We need, he thought, the big numbers that come from institutions, I mean, that like insane asylums, holding all these patients. But we also need the questions to be precise enough that we can get a real specific sense of what kind of a cause you have. Now, I should say his interest was actually especially in the relative potency of heredity coming from male and female lines. So actually different kinds of ancestors: mother's mother, mother's father, father's mother's father, father, and on the way back. And which of these had the most effect on the children, and actually did it have more effect on male or female children? So he has this pretty specific, idea for investigation. And he thought the way to get that kind of data was we couldn't just tally up what the patient or the family members or somebody said in the asylum reports. He wanted instead to have a table to send it around to doctors, and which they would write their name in the upper left, and then they would fill out for families. What the health of a lot of ancestors, and then how this bore on all the children. So he was trying to move from simple kind of, let's say, medical bureaucratic record keeping to something more like medical scientific record keeping. And I don't want to exaggerate the radicalism of his shift, but he definitely thought that the researcher, the doctor had to take a more active role in shaping that kind of investigation. And by the, from quite early, this is in the mid 1840s, and by the mid 1840s, there's already an effort to make this less bureaucratic and more, you know, more an active research. And Bioge is one of those people.
So let's take another step forward then, and I'll ask you to explain what pedigree tables are and why Ludwig Dahls were ahead of their time.
I mean, in some way, it's a hard question. So pedigree tables, that would be, you know, a list of, there are different ways of constructing it. It doesn't always have to start with an ancestor. It might start with the present person and trace their ancestry. So that is say one of them increases by going, backward in time, and one of them increases by going forward in time. If that's clear, that is, if I have two parents and four grandparents and so on, or if we start with my grandparents, the Porter ones had 13 children. So then we had 42, cousins. So it can go either way, but basically whatever way you do it, following a family trait from almost always from an individual. So Dahl, anyhow, who is Norwegian, as it happens, did it from mostly started from a single ancestor and then tried to track it down to all the descendants. He did that in 1859. Tables like that began to be produced in the hundreds and thousands about 1900. So he's way ahead in some ways, or at least I don't want to imply that he's made a scientific discovery that nobody understood for 40 years or something. But he's doing this for his reasons, which they didn't really take, though people thought they were interesting. And then when they did take off, again around 1890s or early 1900s, then people went back and they actually found Dahl and or maybe even they were inspired by him a little bit to do that. I'm not sure. So that's his relation to the story is he seems to be outside, seems to be done something which nobody really either they didn't think to do it, or perhaps they didn't have the means. And it's probably something like not having the means is the better explanation. In any case, the Norwegian or the Scandinavian situation was fairly distinctive. They had actually had what was regarded in Europe as probably the best census of insanity. That is not just counting people in the institutions, but going around and knocking on doors and asking whether there was an insane person there and keeping records like that. And Dahl actually used, and they wrote down the names, and then Dahl actually used those names and a map of the intensity of insanity in different regions to try to find the regions with the highest insanity and to see if he could figure out why. And what kind of a answer might that question give? Well, it might be that there's something in their diet or the weather, or their environmental explanations seem quite possible. Dahl, after a while, determined, but he went and he's using all these records. He tried to find every person who could be counted as insane, or I'll just introduce the word idiotic or idiot, which was a technical term at the time. So some kind of mental, defect or some kind of insanity of mental illness, and tried to find all the people in that community who showed signs of conditions like that, and to, now he uses this a word, the German word is Anlage. The Danes actually write, the Norwegians write in Danish, so the word is spelled A-N-L-A-E-G with that A-E as a joined letter, Anlag or something. But anyhow, he has an idea that he can track this thing, so that the predisposition or the sort of genetic source or hereditary source of insanity can be followed from person to person. He has a great ambition to try. He has these resources available. The Scandinavians and the Norwegian government also paid him to do it, to go try to find out what the causes were. And he in the end used the pedigree table which again is the chart of the you know, family tree with all the persons with certain kinds of hereditary mental conditions or nervous conditions indicated on it. He used that to try to understand, maybe he thought, the reason is nothing to do with the weather or the customs or culture of the place. Maybe it's just that somebody came in with that hereditary factor and spread it. Well, that's the kind of project that he was engaged in, and it becomes, you know, 40 years later, it becomes everybody's favorite way to investigate human heredity.
What was at stake in the debate over the validity of Morel's theory of degeneration?
Okay, so Morel writes there are theories of degeneration of one sort or another going way back. Morel uses the word dégénérescence for a kind of hereditary defect. The understanding of heredity that underlies that kind of investigation is extremely different from what was already quite common among many people interested in heredity, and that would often be doctors who are interested in human heredity. I would say the sort of, maybe it's not fair to say common sense, but I think for us, the common sense understanding of heredity is I would suspect something of being hereditary if the child has the same characteristic as the parents. And Morel's approach here is sharply different. He says that heredity is exhibited by a trajectory of change. That is, so that the hereditary impulse is not causing the children to be like the parents, but causes, at least in some families, a parents with some kind of defect, like a susceptibility to drink or a nervous disorder, to decay, to get worse over the generations, and by not perhaps always, but often leading to the extinction of the decay of the hereditary line and the extinction of the family. So it's a sharply contrasting version of what goes on in heredity. Not like produces like, but that a ancestor with a certain kind of defect is launched on a trajectory of decay, which is going to lead to ever more serious conditions, and then the extinction of the family. Now it comes out of France, and probably it was strongest in France, but it was people were interested in it all over, I think. And the most of the people I'm looking at, the asylum tradition wasn't. I'm not even sure I should say that. Quite a lot of them were less impressed, and the other version of investigation went on, the version of looking for a likeness from parents to their descendants. But it's at stake. Is heredity really about something that's stable and that continues to be transmitted, or is it some kind of a process of decay, which again is not produced by the environment or something, or diet or anything like that, is produced by a tendency of the whatever the hereditary elements are to become less and less viable, to exhibit more and more defects, not because of the environment affecting things, not because of natural selection or something, but just because of this process of decay. So there's some quite serious argument about that, and some people had a big stake in that not being the case.
Thank you for that clarification. So I was struck actually by a statement that you made in chapter 6, where you write that, quote, by 1859, eugenics in a broad sense was old hat. I was wondering if you could expand on this.
Okay, well, I say in a broad sense because the word was not old hat. And the word was made up by Francis Galton, I think 1883. Francis Galton is almost always given credit for, or blame, actually. Nobody says anything nice about eugenics anymore. So Francis Galton is demonized for inventing this whatever science, this claimed science that would try to improve human populations through selective breeding. So 1883, he used the word. He began the research. The first 1865-66, he publishes his first papers on this topic, and then he moved to studying plants and animals, actually mostly peas, interestingly enough, for a while, and then returned slowly to humans again when he began to get more support. So Galton said, he had the insight reading his cousin. His cousin is Charles Darwin, or they both shared one grandfather. Reading his cousin's work on the Charles Darwin's work on natural selection. That's 1859. So 1859 is his date, which for that reason, because Galton is given, or because eugenics is attributed to Galton, because Galton explained his inspiration in terms of Charles Darwin's work, and Charles Darwin's 1859 for historians of science is just one of those most central of years, most important of years. So if we think that eugenics is kind of an outgrowth of the Darwinian evolutionary tradition, then 1859 and 1865 look like very important dates. And I'm saying, without saying that this is a full-blooded eugenics, I'm saying that the asylum doctors were anxious about the reproduction of the condition they treated, and were talking about the need to prevent or to do what they could to block the reproduction of those people who had this inherited defect, and to warn people not to marry into families that showed those defects. That was a very common kind of discussion within the medical alienists, the asylum doctors, going back to at least to the 1840s, and we can find quite a lot of it even before that.
Do you actually want to spend a little bit more time talking about selective or so-called rational breeding as social medicine as you discuss it?
This is the other thing I guess I would say is that the asylum movement was born in a spirit of massive optimism. They thought that a gentle kind of treatment applied early, putting the patients in a situation where they could recover, where they through naturalistic, that is like working in men working in the fields, women in the laundries, and so on. This kind of routinized, undemanding in a way, labor that they could recover. They show among I mentioned the asylum tables. They always had tables of cures. These were extremely favorable at first, especially in the United States and to some degree in other countries. But what happened was, although they claimed a lot of cures, the asylum population just went through the roof. It was unbelievable. It was way faster than the growth of population. It became extremely expensive. The asylum doctors were deeply discouraged by this. What has gone wrong? What can we do? Well, meanwhile, so they're not the treatment. They didn't give up the effort to treat patients, and they continued to think that they were curing some of them. But meanwhile, there were other ways they could. They hoped they could cut off the expansion of this terrible condition. And the one they got most interested in was blocking its reproduction. A different kind of public health move. The asylum was a public health institution. The doctors in the asylums saw their role not just as treating the patients in their asylums, but also in controlling the growth of insanity in the population at large. And they came to see changing patterns of reproduction, and above all, keeping the insane from marrying and having children, as the most promising way they had to continue to stop the increase of this terrible disease.
So significant portions of your discussion in part three of the book require familiarity with the concept of Mendelian genetics and single factor inheritance. I was wondering if you could give our listeners just a refresher on this concept and then discuss it within the debates between biometricians and medical Mendelianists within Britain and America.
Well, so Mendelism, again, I said a little bit about this already. Mendelism, if the word gene comes into it a little bit later, but I'll just use that word, the idea that the gene codes for something, and perhaps something that we can see, you know, directly. So perhaps the traits that we have ordinary names for, like mental illness, perhaps that's one or a few genes. That would be the idea. The controversy was, so let's say those who opposed this view didn't necessarily deny that occasionally a trait, you know, like exhibited the characteristics of Mendelism, which would be, the word is first segregation, that is, it divides into distinct types, not a continuum, but distinct types. And then that those types tend to reproduce themselves or actually reproduce themselves in these very specific Mendelian ratios. And the biometric approach either doubted that. I mean, actually, I don't find anybody who denied that there was that sometimes there was Mendelian segregation, which I say again is a splitting into two distinct types. So they thought that was uncommon, and that for most of the traits that really mattered, especially human traits like intelligence or insanity, that these things actually came in degrees, and it was better to measure the trait than to suppose that every time you found a person who was in a mental institution that they had the gene for insanity or the gene for intelligence or, you know, athletic ability or whatever it was you were interested in. So it's the biometric approach, the phenotype is the characteristic of the organism, and and genotype is the array of genes. And the asylum tradition of human heredity rarely, the analog is curiously like a gene, mostly they were looking at characteristics and how they were reproduced. They were not mostly trying to find the gene and to see whether it, you know, see how it behaved.
Who were Wilhelm Weinberg and Ernst Rudin, and why are they central figures in your story?
So Weinberg and Rudin are important German researchers on heredity. Rudin is the more kind of established figure, and he comes out of psychiatric institutions called clinics that began in the late 19th century, and that allowed for research on insanity, on various things, but including the causes. And his institution, actually, it's originally the institution. It's in Munich, and it's originally an institution which was it's a place where the classification of insanity was redefined and becomes quite powerful. Rudin became the head of what was called the demographic division, and interested exactly in the kind of how to understand the growth of insanity and how to check that growth. So and Rudin was an early convert to a Mendelian kind of understanding of heredity. Early means 1908 or so. That's about 8 years after Mendel became famous among botanists. And he helped to show that insanity was inherited in that Mendelian way that would produce its characteristic ratios and would show that kind of discrimination or that kind of split between those who had it and those who didn't. Weinberg is a different person. Rudin is in the center of psychiatric power in Munich. Weinberg was in Stuttgart in southwestern Germany, a public health physician. He presided over a lot of births. He was engaged with the medical statistics of the area, and he became rather expert in statistics. He also learned some things from Francis Galton's kind of statistics and Carl Pearson, who continued that and developed that tradition in the early 20th century. So they did an influential project about 1912, 13, 14 to try to establish, with using all the best research techniques, that really once you made all the necessary corrections, it would prove to be, the categories, the newly developed categories of dementia praecox, or which is kind of schizophrenia, or manic depressive disorder, that these would show the Mendelian characteristics. They did the experiment with all the statistics that was available of the time, and again 1912, 13, 14, and the result, which they hope to get a ratio of in a certain group of 25% insane, they got something like 4.5%. So they were deeply disappointed by that, and they proceeded with Rudin now continued to hope that he would establish, the real Mendelian basis for insanity, went on with a more empirical approach, again, empirical phenotypic, that is looking at the trait. He had funds from a rich American financial guy, and then actually later from the Rockefeller Foundation. So he was very prestigious and very well supported to carry on this work and to try to establish what the real problems were, the real genetic causes of insanity. He also was prepared to intervene. He was that was very important for him, though. He always said that any kind of accepting sterilization would always be a choice of the person sterilized, until 1933, when the Nazis came to power and they almost immediately passed a mandatory sterilization law, and Rudin supported that completely and favored its implementation in a quite forceful way. Because he was not alone, but he and a few other human genetics types or human students of human heredity had the kind of expertise that made them very influential or trying to implement figuring out how to implement the Nazi sterilization law.
So how, in a little bit more detail, was empirical heredity prognosis used then in Germany during that period to support the 1934 sterilization law?
Okay, well, first, you don't want to exaggerate the extent to which what they said they were going to do was actually done. I have seen some of these interesting forms on which they registered the information that was required to sterilize, and some people were sterilized for hereditary reasons under the hereditary law without a single relative with mental illness being identified. So we don't want to suppose that they adhere to their own standards. It's a not for nothing were they the Nazis, the kind of evidence that Rudin was already producing before the Nazis and continued to show afterwards was looking at the descendants, the offspring and the descendants of people who had been diagnosed as insane, by this time schizophrenia or manic depressive, and looking to see how many of their children or other kinds of relatives, how much did the probability of showing this kind of mental illness increase in the children when it had been diagnosed in the parents? And actually, that's a little bit too simple, because he also was very interested in sort of in-between conditions he called psychopathy and neuropathy, which are not full mental illness. But anyhow, using these rather loose categories, he ends up with a huge number of people who are a huge percentage of people who show mental illness because their family members, or you know, he says, on account of inheriting it from their family members. And that kind of argument was very valuable for pushing the law in the first place, and probably, I mean, so it has some role in pushing the law in the first place, and then provided an argument for a lot of sterilizations. Now, I'm actually not going to say that argument that Rudin was, no, he was he favored the sterilizations, but I don't have an estimate as to how many of them or how much it was increased on account of the work that he did, but he was absolutely supporting it, and his claims and his rhetoric were important for justifying the sterilization law and its implementation.
Well, unfortunately, we're about to run out of time, so I wanted to end on this last question, which is, I wanted to know, what was the most unexpected discovery that you made while conducting research for this book?
There are lots of little discoveries, like people I never heard of who proved to be, you know, quite influential. I go into this with quite a lot of not expecting a very high quality of work. And while I'm not going to say that the work is brilliant, there were actually quite a lot of serious people. And in a way, the thing that shocked me or surprised me most, and it happened actually right at the start when the rather less original kind of work I was planning to do turned into this project on the study of the inheritance of mental illness and feeble-mindedness, was just to discover that there was this huge tradition that nobody, including me, seemed to have noticed, or at least noticed as a thing that mattered much, and that the doctors were not, you know, the doctors doing this kind of work were not just gathering data. It made sense to me that a person like people like Carl Pearson or Rudin would use the data that was available to them to study conditions that they were interested in, like mental illness. It turned out that the doctors were already deeply into this kind of study. That was true in the United States. It was true in Britain. It was true in Germany, Switzerland, Scandinavia, France. And that there was this whole tradition of investigation, statistical, based on the data, which, again, nobody had really noticed, including me, and which was a serious tradition. And that kind of opened up the topic for me, and sent me back all the way. And then the other, maybe less astonishing surprise, was that this is completely continuous with the traditions, with the Mendelian and the biometric traditions where the study of human heredity really developed in the early 20th century. That they're using the data, they were depending on the expertise of, by this time, alienists or psychiatrists, asylum doctors, and also by this time a school psychologist who studied mental weakness. So it was just really this recognition, this discovery that there's this whole tradition I didn't know anything about, and was really quite a serious enterprise going on for most of a century before the work that we identify with genetics took off, you know, around 1900.
Well, thank you so much for bringing these hidden histories to light and for your time, Dr. Porter.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening. This has been New Books in Science.